Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Richard Smallwood, one of gospel greats. He's a legend in his own time. Before we begin, I'm going to play one of his titles called Total Praise, and we'll have Richard on the line, and we'll go ahead and conduct our interview after that. Again, Total Praise, Richard Smallwood.
Thank you.
Well, Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I guess to go back for a moment, I just talked to you before the we went on the air. A lot of our listeners like to hear personal stories of people, of our guests, versus reading the bio. So kind of tell us about where you're from and tell us about yourself.
Well, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, but only stayed there for a very short period of time and actually consider my home D.C. because I've been here most of my life. And so grew up here for the most of my childhood here in D.C. and the son of a preacher and been playing music all my life, singing, playing, writing, went to Howard University, where I got my undergrad degree in piano. I was a piano major. And then in 2004, I actually went back to Howard School of Divinity and got my master's in divinity. And been doing this, what I've been doing, for about 30 years now, recording and doing music ministry.
Wow. So tell us about, I guess, the early years of people who inspired you as musicians and preachers, and when you discern and say, hey, I want to do this. This is going to be my ministry. This is going to be me for life. Tell us about those moments.
I think I've always known it. There's never been a time when I really wanted to do anything else. My mother says that when I was, very small, I was still in the crib and wasn't talking yet, I would hum melodies that I would hear at church. I mean, complete melodies, which would sort of freak her out. And she sort of knew that, I had musical talent. So they got me, when I was two, they got me a baby grand piano, toy baby grand piano that would fit in the crib with me. And they say that I would bang out the rhythms on the toy piano and hum whatever the melody was in my head. Mm-hmm. So I've always known it. When I was probably seven, I started playing for my father's church. My mother exposed me to gospel music. As far back as I can remember. So when I was coming up, I came up during probably the middle to the end of the golden age, golden era of gospel music, with people like the Roberta Martin singers, Clara Ward and the Ward singers, the Davis sisters. Those were my influences when I was very, very small. As I got older, my teenage years, it was more like James Cleveland, people of that nature. And when I got to Howard, Edwin Hawkins probably was my biggest musical influence in terms of the way he wrote and that he used, the harmonic progressions that he used, getting away from the old traditional style of gospel chords. So he inspired me to actually write. It's been a sort of a natural progression and something that I've always known and never really wanted to do anything else but what I do now.
Well, tell us regarding this progression. If we step a moment back from the 60s to today, how gospel music has progressed back from when you started playing at church to where it is today?
Well, I think that the main thing is because of the different types of mediums now, its exposure and its acceptance is much more than it was when I first started out. You know, gospel music was something that was, really done in church on Sunday mornings and basically storefront churches. That was the train of thought of when people thought about gospel music. But now, I mean, with record labels getting behind it for a number of years and treating it, giving you the same kind of budgets that you give any other kind of music to really make the best product that you can, it's been delivered to the masses through YouTube, through all different types of mediums. And, of course, You hear it in plays, you hear it on television commercials, you hear it everywhere, you know, all over the world. When I travel in Europe, you know, most of the places that I go have gospel choirs: Norway, Japan, Sweden, Italy. You know, all these places have, you know, gospel choirs, and gospel music is a part of their culture now. They have embraced it. So, you know, it's really widespread now, more than I ever thought I would, you know, live to see.
It's kind of amazing because back during that time, some churches, you had not divisions, but you had styles of congregation. You have the old 100s. You had the high church type music. And then you had this movement of gospel coming in. I can remember back in the time that a lot of the certain congregations just didn't like gospel music whatsoever because it expressed more than they felt comfortable in expressing. But if you took the spiritual, which I didn't understand coming from the outside, I said, well, if I take the musical elements as a spiritual and maybe leave out the music, I still end up with the same thing. Why do you think it was that they really wasn't embracing it back in the 70s? And even in the 80s, then finally it caught a hold on fire and spread throughout the world.
Well, you know, it had everything to do with culture. I mean, I think the unfortunate thing is, and this even spread from the church setting to the university setting, because they didn't allow it at Howard University. When I was a freshman there, it was something that you didn't do, and you didn't get caught doing in the, you know, in the fine arts building or in the practice area. But I think the thing is, our culture had been brainwashed so that anything that, you know, came from us, came from our souls, came from our spirits, was deemed as being not worthy. So they embraced European style of music or European style of worship. A lot of churches didn't want to show any kind of emotionalism or any kind of outward signs of jubilation. It was all very quiet, very staid, and, you know, there were some churches, they wouldn't even allow you to bring drums. And when I first started out, I remember we had to sing at a church, and the pastor said, oh, you can't bring those drums in here, you know. So, I mean, it was that I think that reminded them of where they came from, and they were trying to embrace this new, quote, Anglo-Saxon, unquote, type thing that they felt that was really showing them as being high class and you know, on a different level. So they looked down on, you know, the very thing that we created.
Wow. So even taking when I was talking to Evan Hawkins a few months ago, and we were talking about Old Happy Day when he first started, I said, once his style took a fire and became mainstream, from that point on is when this new movement of music came in. Do you start to see the shift? Because now we, maybe grandma and grandma might not accept it, but however, we're going to start a new church, and the like minds and like bodies, we're going to start this particular movement, and this is the type of music we're going to go from then on.
Well, you know, yeah, music is like anything. It's a cycle, you know. And if you look back in history, there have been certain people that have come on the scene that have changed the way or the way that we look at music, or the way that we listen to music, or even the way that we perform music. I mean, if you want to go back to the early 30s and see Thomas A. Dorsey, who was chastised for bringing that kind of music into the church. He was influenced by the blues and by what we call barrel house music, which was the music that they played in the clubs of that day. But you know, when he gave his life to Christ and came to the church, they looked down on him because they said, you know, we're not going to have that kind of shaking and that kind of rolling and that kind of rocking up in here, you know. So Mahalia Jackson was given the same kind of treatment for many of those high Baptist churches, and the same thing when Edwin came along, the same thing when Kirk Franklin came along. So, you know, there are always people who come by who change come along who changed the face of gospel music, but being a pioneer, being a trailblazer is always difficult because you're plowing new ground, so people don't want to accept it. They don't know what it is. They're used to doing it the old way, and this is new. This chord is new. This beat is new. So we're not going to accept it. So it's a challenge for anyone to come along and do different things. And I think that's part of the territory that comes with being a trailblazer or a pioneer.
When you actually started with your particular style and from the crib, you started humming and you got your baby piano in your crib and started humming tunes, what was your influence at that time? Was it coming from the South made a difference of embracing some of those hymns, and then in your mind you merged that into something else and created that? Kind of tell us about that particular moment of, I'm sure, middle school and high school, when you start expanding out and playing in the church. How did all of that develop?
Well, you know, I mean, growing up in my home, like I said, the early years was traditional gospel music, such as Clara Ward, such as Roberta Martin, David Sisters. Those are people that I embraced. Those are people that my mother took me to see, and I would emulate the people who were playing on the piano, their accompanists, or whoever. And then, of course, at the same time, my stepfather, who was a pastor, was a stickler about hymns. So he made sure that I learned all the hymns, all the traditional hymns, the Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross, the Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, the Oh God, I Help in Ages Past, all of those hymns. We would go through the hymn book one by one. I have to play them in different keys, and he'd stand behind me and make sure that I was playing them right. And then my mother listened to people like Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, Rosemary Clooney, people like that. So I heard that on the radio, and she also listened to classical music. When I was 11 or either 10 years old, she brought me home a recording of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 and says, you know, I want to expose you to this, and if you like it, I'll take you to some concerts. So I fell in love with this new, you know, genre of music that I'd never heard before, and so my mother would take me to hear maybe the Martin singers on Saturday night, and on Sunday night she'd take me to hear the National Symphony Orchestra, you know. So and then somewhere in my teen years, I really got into Broadway music. Rodgers and Hammerstein and The Sound of Music and My Fair Lady and all those great Broadway shows. And so I think I didn't really seriously start writing until I was in my late teens, probably 18 or 19. And when I started writing, all those influences, including the classical, including the Broadway, including all the stuff that I'd ever been exposed to, began to come out. You know, and it was different. And I remember record companies telling me what I was writing was not commercial, and it would never sell, and it was trash, and it was no good. But it's all I knew how to do. And I believe that God had given me that kind of style and that kind of way of approaching music for a reason. So I just kept plowing away and kept doing, you know, what I did until somebody finally said, "Hey, this is not bad." That's sort of how it went.
So when you went to Howard, and when you had all these pieces in your mind at school, then it started to kind of merge to your particular style at that point?
Yeah, that's definitely when it started. And when Edwin came on the scene with Oh Happy Day, Oh Happy Day actually was one of the more traditional type songs that was on that project. He had some more songs where the chord, like I Was Glad When They Said Unto Me, and some other songs that had harmonic progressions that you just didn't hear in the church. So when I began to write, with him in mind, trying to use some of those new progressions, but of course using the classical and all the other influences that I had. So it really started probably at Howard more than anywhere else, because that's when I really started writing and started, you know, trying to find my composer side. So that's really when it all started, and all those, you know, influences just started to come out. I didn't sit down and say, I think I'm going to write something that sounds like this. It was just when I wrote, everything that I knew musically came out. It wasn't a conscious, you know, kind of decision. It was just who I was.
Do you think as a composer, all of this energy that's built into you, this creativity, this God-given talent, then all of a sudden you just burst out of the seams of all the stuff that's been in, that's in your soul, and you just do one song after the other, one after the other, because all of it is now coming out of you. Can you just describe how that process works? When you, hey, I have this idea, I'm going to sit there and write it out, this one song, number one, song number two, because it seemed like at one point, yeah, you do have some songs, but then all of a sudden you just have burst of composers that start writing everything that comes out of them, and they're all different.
Yeah, I think it depends on the person. It depends on the composer. I think everybody probably approaches it differently. Certainly my songs come in all different kinds of ways. Sometimes I'll just get an idea, a melody, or sometimes I'll get a chorus just sort of going over and over in my head. And usually they will not go away until I sit down at the piano and really develop, you know, what God is trying to give me. And there are times, especially here recently in the past, I guess, 8 or 9 years, where a lot of songs have started to come to me in dreams. So I'll wake up with a particular melody or a vamp sometimes, or even a introduction, like a opening introduction to a song sometimes. So, you know, they come in different ways. I have friends who are composers who sit and write every day. I'm not one of those kinds of people to do that. Sometimes I'll go a year or two without even writing. But when it hits me, I got to get it out, or it'll drive me crazy. So it's almost like somebody's playing a loop over in your head, and it won't go away. You hear it, you think of it day and night. When you're going to sleep, you hear it. When you wake up, you hear it. And, you know, until I develop it and really start developing it into a song, it's going to stay there, and it's going to stay there until I finish the song. And once I finish the song, you know, I'm done with it. But it's just like some kind of driving, sometimes annoying kind of thing that just happens until you get that song finished, completed.
It has to come out.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break one moment, then we're going to talk about your early career and bring us to the present. We'll be back in a moment with Richard Smallwood, so you can take a break. We'll be back in 1 minute. You listen to The Core Business Show.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
Well, we're back in interview with Richard Smallwood. If you want to call in, please press the number 1. The number is 347-324-3460. I guess, Richard, kind of tell us about your early career. As much as I remember, 1980, you had maybe an album or two out, and you had one title song, I think it's Oh Lord, Come By Here, an adaptation of that?
Yes, actually. It was 1982 when the first album was released, and I signed with Benson Records in 1981, which was my first record deal, and actually the hit off of that first album was I Love the Lord. That was the one that sort of swept the country. And of course, Come By Here was on that album as well as oh my God, it's been so long ago. I've Got Something This World Can't Take Away, and Donald Lawrence did not long ago redid it. That was the first. I think I Love the Lord was the one that sort of let people sort of be aware of who the Smallwood Singers were and what I was doing. But even before then, like I Love the Lord was written in 1975. So when I was in school, actually in grad school, so my church choir recorded it and we sang it around the country. The late Donald Vales heard it. He recorded it. The late Albertina Walker heard it. She recorded it, as well as a number of other, artists that recorded actually before the Smallwood Singers ever, did the first album. So, and I also had been playing for Tremaine Hawkins. I had been playing for Edwin Hawkins. So I'd been touring with them. So although I hadn't been recording, my music was sort of still starting to get out there, and was traveling and doing, sort of getting into what it was that I really wanted to do in terms of my career and my ministry.
Okay. If anybody have any questions, that's dial 1, and we'll put you on the air. Tell us about I Love the Lord. It's a mixture. Tell us about how you came up with that particular piece and what it entails, because the chord progression is different. Everybody can't sing it. But once you have the right voices, it's an awesome piece of work.
Thank you. Well, wow. Like I said, I went back to grad school to major in music for a minute, and then I stopped and started traveling and doing what it is that I do. But while I was in grad school, my church choir, my then home church, was Union Temple here in Washington, D.C., and they were doing, we had done one album, like a, an independent sort of custom album that we did and, sold to church members and family members and whatever. And the second one we were getting ready to record, which was called Give Us Peace, and I needed to write some songs for that, and I was down at Howard in the practice area, and the words to that, are one of those old hymns that I grew up hearing. And I just wanted to set it to some new music, and the melody just sort of came to me while I was, fiddling around on the piano in the practice area at Howard, and that's basically, where it came from.
Wow. Yeah, it's kind of amazing in music school during that earlier period. Teachers usually run out of the music, out of their offices, hearing one lick of gospel.
Oh yeah.
Throwing people out of the during that time, throwing people out of the music room. And if you want to practice with a musical group, you got to do it after hours, after they have left campus.
After they left, that's right. We even had a guard who used to patrol the halls, and if he heard you playing before, during hours or after hours, because he was a security guard, so he would stay until the building closed, he would report you to the dean, and you would get reprimanded, So, of course, a lot of people don't know, but a lot of us who were students at Howard University banded together and had a takeover, and we took over the Fine Arts Building because the dean would not hear us or hear our request in terms of establishing African American music other than African American classical music or Negro spirituals into our curriculum. We had no jazz band, we had no jazz department, we had no African American music studies. Everything was classical, which I had no problem with because I grew up on classical music. But I was like, if we can hear their music and experience their music, why can't we experience our own? So we took over Fine Arts Building. We pulled the piano out on the front steps, and I played gospel music for about 3 or 4 days, I guess. and we wouldn't let anybody in the building until the dean finally, I guess, said, well, in order to get rid of these fools, let's hear what they got to say. And we presented our lists of grievances and what we wanted, and that's how the jazz department got started at Howard University.
Wow.
Because they were not allowing any kinds of black music that was not either Negro spirituals or classical oriented.
It's kind of strange because you go right down the street to the other schools, the other
right.
schools, you know, Georgetown. They're playing it. They have the departments and the budgets and so forth.
Listen,
for it. Go ahead.
When I graduated from Howard, the first job that I got, the University of Maryland, which is not a black institution, said, we want you to come and take over our gospel choir, and we want to make it a part of the School of Music, Department of Music, and we want, you know, the students who do take it to get a credit for it. So it'll be like a class. Now, they wouldn't even let us sing it at Howard, you know, at that time. And here's a, you know, a non-black university saying, we want to incorporate this into our curriculum, you know, and give the students, you know, a credit for it. So it just goes to show you how, you know, our minds had been really sort of confused about a lot of things, especially things that we had done and we had created ourselves as being something less than good.
Just go back real quick regarding I Love the Lord. How did that come about within the Preacher's Wife movie when they came to you?
Mervyn Warren, who formerly of Take Six, and actually who's the musical director for The Preacher's Wife, called me and said, you know, Whitney asked me to call you because we're doing this movie called The Preacher's Wife. And she grew up singing I Love the Lord in church, and it's one of her favorite songs. And she wanted to know, you know, would you be opposed to her doing it in the movie? I'm like, of course I would not be opposed. I'd be more than happy. You know, so that's basically how it happened. It was a song that she knew, a song that she loved, and clearly used to sing it, you know, when she was coming up in Newark at her home church. So that's basically how that came about.
When you finally heard the recording, not only, you know, you heard your music done in a certain way, but just hearing a voice like that, every musician's dream of
right.
someone great, but someone singing your music and just taking it a song to their own way, to another level. What does that feel like?
It was incredible. I remember, you know, while they were actually working on it, they were sending me, like, rough copies of what she was doing in the studio, you know. So I sort of heard it, although I wasn't there in person, I sort of heard it being built from the ground up and that kind of thing. Of course, they would call and ask, did I have any suggestions? And I was just like, let her sing it like she feels it. That's, you know, she got the melody. That's all she needs, you know. And so, of course, hearing the, you know, the final project was just an incredible thing. It was an incredible feeling. And I think it's that way. I don't think it's anything you ever get used to. I mean, because it's people that you admire, people that are you know, great musicians, great singers, or whoever. And when you hear them, you know, do your music, it just sort of blows you away. And it's certainly something that I never get used to. I'm always honored, and I'm always, you know, grateful that they love what I do that much to even want to, you know, to do it.
When it came to the progression of the very end of that particular song, how did that, because it has like two different sections, and this is the third, how did you come up with that idea of the very end?
You mean I hasten to his throne?
Hasten to his throne.
Honestly, I do not remember. You know, we're talking 1975 here, so...
Has it stayed intact since then, or has it progressed?
It's the exact same way that I did it when I first wrote it. The only difference is that when we first, and I don't think we didn't even do this when Smallwood Singers recorded it, but before we recorded it on our Hasten to His Throne. I would split the choir, and some were singing "I'll Hasten to His I'll Hasten to His Throne," and the others were doing sort of a fugue kind of thing on the syllable "do." You know, and the mm-hmm. altos would do something in counterpoint to that, and the tenors would do something in counterpoint to that. And when we got to the smallest thing, got to the album, you know, we were like, I think this is going to be too difficult because we really think that it's a song that people are going to want to sing, but they'll never be able to figure out that part. So just saying "I'll Hasten to His Throne" and leave the do's out. So that's really the only difference than the very, very original one, you know, had.
Wow. Your style, even coming from 82, and, you know, you took the Clark Sisters, you took the Hawkins, James Cleveland, all had a different style. Yours were took a different direction in itself that we haven't heard of, but it wasn't from this end to this end, if it's making sense. Yours came way over here and brought a new level for ensemble music. Kind of describe, this is the way you felt at the time. This is who you are. You just want to be you and not be in this particular box in one sense.
Exactly.
In your style of music.
Exactly. I mean, I wasn't trying to be different, or I wasn't trying to do something, you know, earth-shattering that no one had done before. It was just who I was. The hard part was the record labels trying to make me be someone who I wasn't. I remember on the very first album, they put this producer, the White Brother, with me and said, you know, we want him to produce the album. I had never produced anything in my life other than my little church album, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just making it up as I went along. So I was excited to get a professional producer. He had produced Lana Harris and Sandy Patty, and he had like a, you know, a really great track record, you know, but he hears my music and he says that, you know, basically it's junk, and that they would have to find some material for me to record. So I, you know, for about 4 or 5 days, they took me into a vault with all this music and let me hear all this stuff to try to find something, you know, that I liked. And I kept saying, I mean, you know, all this music is nice, and I think it's great, but it's not me, you know. So after about the fourth day, he just really got frustrated. He said, you know, well, what is you? You know, what music is you? He said, play something that speaks to who you are. So I sat down and played "Light of the Lord." He said, okay, that's a great song. Who wrote that? I was like, I did. And, of course, he had the tape with all the music on it, so clearly he didn't listen to it, you know, all mm-hmm. the demo that I'd recorded with all this music on it. So he was like, well, play something else. So I played another song, "I've Got Something" or something, and he's like, well, yeah, okay, now I like that melody. Who wrote that? Well, I did, you know. So we went through that for like about 45 minutes, and then he calls me at the hotel. I was down in Nashville. He called me at the hotel that night. I got a great idea for the record. And I was like, what? He was like, let's record your music. So I went through, you know, all this stuff, you know, like about a week of being told that I couldn't write. No one was writing anything like that. It didn't make sense. No one would understand it. Why is the classical stuff in there? And, you know, all this kind of stuff. And you know, to the point where he finally says, okay, let's record your music. So that's, you know, trying to... You know, and just going back, like I was saying before, with Edwin and Kurt and Thomas Dorsey and other people like that, you know, it's always hard going against the grain, coming in, doing something that nobody else is doing, because the music industry is very narrow-minded in terms of they look at what's a hit. So if somebody comes out and makes a hit, they want everybody to sound like that one particular person. Sing like them, write like them, whatever. So it's like it doesn't leave room for creativity. You have to. They try to put you in this box and make you fit. And for me, it was like trying to put a square peg in a round hole because I didn't fit. That was not me. So I just had to keep, you know, elbowing my way and say, hey, this is me, I'm going to do this, until finally somebody, you know, would listen.
Do you think they were intimidated?
I don't know. I remember the producer who did the first album, when we were recording I Love the Lord, and I was doing the they had all these session musicians from Nashville. So I was the only, you know, little black brother there playing the piano. And so somewhere near end of the song, I'm playing, and all of a sudden the producer says, that was the wrong chord that you just played. And I was like, a wrong chord? So I said, well, maybe my finger slipped or something. So I went back and did it again. He said, no, that's wrong, that's wrong. And I said, why is that wrong? He said, because it makes sense. So I was like, well, it makes sense to me. He says, I'm the producer, it doesn't make sense. So, I mean, you know, I come from the radical kind of Howard University kind of background. And I was like, wait a minute, you know. So he calls, so he breaks the session and says, okay, let's have a break. I need to talk to you. So I said, okay. So he had no idea that I had been musically trained or I had a degree in music. I don't know what he thought. So he brings me in the room. He goes to explain why this chord is wrong. So I let him finish. And when he finished, I said, well, actually, the chord that you have in question is called a secondary dominant. And the role of a secondary dominant is that although it's not related to the key, and I went on to explain to him what it was, and he sat there and looked at me and turned like really, really red, and then he said, let's break. You know, so we went to lunch, and he came back. He said, the chord is fine. Just use the chord. So, you know, it was a really strange kind of situation that I had to continue to go through. Like I had to keep trying to prove myself to people who I guess didn't understand what I was doing or certainly didn't believe in what I was doing. So it was quite a journey.
Wow. So if we bring you back to 10 years in the future to 95 or 96 when you came out with Total Praise, the Adoration album, tell us about that journey. Because now you moved from the ensemble back to a choir now. Tell us how that came to be.
Well, for probably during the time of the Smallwood Singers, for near the end of the Smallwood Singer era, I guess for about 7 or 8 years, God had been dealing with me to start a new group. And I'm not a person who embraces change very well, and I was like, I've been doing this all these years, you know, what are people going to say if I come out, you know, with a choir ensemble? They're going to be like, where are the Smallwood Singers, you know? And so I decided what I would do was to do a one-album thing, and I'd get some people together who I knew and just form like a little ensemble, not an official thing, and do that. I said, maybe this is what God is talking about. Certainly I had no idea or plans to do it as a ongoing thing. And at the same time, my godbrother was very ill, battling with brain cancer. And actually I was his caregiver. And so it was a very difficult time for me. A lot of things were going on in my life. And I was sitting at the piano one day, and Total Praise just like popped into my mind. Like I tell sometimes when I'm doing songwriting classes, I'll say to the students that there are times when you get music that it seems like it's already written. You're just like the conduit or the vessel that it comes through, because it comes through you completed. You don't go back and, you know, tinker with the melody or the rhythm or the harmonies. You know this is it, and that's how Total Praise, you know, came to me. And at the point where it was given to me, I was going through a difficult time because my mother was ill at the same time, and it was really depressing, you know, with so many family members who were ill and looking to me, and I felt so helpless and you know, unprepared to deal with it. And God just sort of gave me that song in the middle of my depression and just told me, you know, I see your tears and I feel your pain, but I still need your praise even in your valley situation that you're going through, because I still got your back, and, you know, it's going to come out. You know, it's working for your good, even though you can't see it or feel it right now. And it was that's where the song just sort of came from. It just sort of flowed through me, and I taught it to I got Vision together and taught it to them, and I think that was the end of rehearsal when I taught it, because everybody was just like went forth in a total praise, literally. Little did I know that it was gonna take off the way that it did, but whenever I should have known, because whenever I let somebody hear it, the reaction was always the same. And my manager heard it; he had tears in his eyes, and I've never seen my manager cry, you know. And so God just sort of took that song and just sort of took me to a new level in my ministry, and took me to places that I certainly had never been before, and you know, into situations and open the doors that certainly I never dreamed of would be open. So, you know, I think it was just God's natural way of progressing me to where I was predestined to go.
So on the Amen portion at the very end of the piece, how did that actually flow then as a third element?
It just came. I just remember when I finished the song, the middle portion of the song, it was I just wanted a big ending. I wanted an amen, like a prayer, like the end of a prayer or something like that. And that concept just popped into my head. And I remember one of those four-track recorders. I could hear it in my mind, but I really needed to hear someone sing it. So I remember I recorded all the tracks, all the parts, rather, on this four-track recording where I could put one part down on one track and then play them together and to make sure what I was hearing in my head made sense in terms of the amens. And that's basically how it came to be.
When you transitioned after that, went to Live in Detroit and then Persuaded, progression of the same format of pieces, more for choir. When you got to Persuaded with this anthem of praise and the other pieces, it seemed like you had more of a vision of, I'm going to say, more theatrical. It had another vision at the very beginning that the other pieces didn't have.
Well, actually Anthem of Praise came to me in an airport.
Wow.
And I was like, what is this? And I remember just putting it down on my phone, what I could remember. And, of course, once I got back, I just started doing it piece by piece. In fact, it took me a while for it to come together. Even sometimes when I would come and teach it, I didn't like what I hear, and I would say, scratch that, and I'd go back to the drawing board at home and then come back and redo it. So because of the kind of song I envisioned it being, an anthem, something very grand, something very, pomp and circumstance kind of feel to it, but still gospel, I wanted an introduction that would introduce it, because I wanted it to be the first song on the project. So I wanted something that would sort of set the tone for where this was going. Because in my mind, I could see, the Levitical priest, carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and this procession through the holy city, and that kind of thing. And so one of my proteges, Darren Atwater, who was just an incredible orchestrator and musician, and played for me a number of years. I called him and I said, I want this. I let him hear what I was doing, and I said, I want something that goes in the beginning of that, that's really going to set the stage. It's the first song in the actual concert recording, but I also wanted to set the stage for this song as well as the concert. And so that he came up with the whole March of the Priest, you know, thing in the beginning. So that's basically how it started. You know, I just sort of go with what I feel or what I hear.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't necessarily sit down and plan, I'm going to go this way or I'm going to do something different this way. It's just basically where I am at that time in my life, what's going on in my life, and what I hear musically and where I am musically.
I have a question here from the chat room. They're asking about, are there any musical arrangements from those albums for orchestra? I guess I'm assuming from the Adoration and this particular
for orchestra,
album.
Orchestra, there are some. It depends on which album it is. Some they would have to get in touch with Darren Atwater. The other they would have to get in touch with Stephen Ford, depending on what album they were talking about. But there's songbooks, you know, to all of those albums, starting back with with Live in Atlanta. There's been a songbook, so even those who want just the accompaniment or the right vocal parts, there's songbooks for that as well.
So Stephen Ford, if they go to his website, they can try to get the arrangements from...
Yeah, the arrangements from Promises, the arrangements from Journey, for the Live in D.C. Persuaded album, that would be Darren Atwater.
Okay. And does Darren Atwater have a website?
You can just go to Darren Atwater at AOL.com and just hit him up on his email. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Last couple of questions. When it went into your other projects, from Journey up to the present to Promises, kind of tell us about those particular pieces from that point to your last album.
Well, Journey was something I really wanted to do because I wanted to work with some of the people that really meant a lot to me. Who had been influenced me in some kind of way musically. So what I did in Journey, we did that live in New York, and I contacted Chaka Khan and asked her what she'd be a part of, and she graciously accepted. I contacted my friends, the Hawkins family, my dear friend Walter, who's no longer with us, you know, and said, I want the family back together because I want you a part of this album. So he and I wrote songs together for the family for that particular project. Of course, I wrote one for Chaka. I had Kelly Price there and other people whose voices I really admired and always wanted to work with. And it was a great celebration there at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. So the songs from that particular project, other than the couple of ones we did by ourselves, were basically songs that were written especially for those people's voices or those people's styles and that kind of thing.
And what was that experience like?
It was great.
Just working
it was incredible.
It
was incredible. It was incredible. Everybody was so happy to be a part of it, and actually Aretha Franklin was supposed to be a part of that night as well, but there was some scheduling conflicts, and we couldn't pull it off. So actually, the song that she was going to record that night, she actually recorded on her last album. So that was a thrill, too. I grew up listening to Aretha. So, you know.
Wow.
But it was a great experience. I mean, there were no – and, of course, I've known the Hawkins since I was 19 years old. So, I mean, they're friends, you know. And then Chaka was just a beautiful person who had recently – been turned on to my music through a song I wrote for Karen Clark Sheard, A Secret Place. She had been singing it, and then when she researched it, she started really getting into other stuff that I'd been doing and called me and told me she was doing A Secret Place on TBN and wanted to know would I fly out and play it for her. You know, so I was like, are you serious? I'll walk to California and play it for you. You know, so it started a relationship then, and she became a part of the, you know, the album. So that night was just an incredible night. It was hard to put it together, just the logistics of the thing, being in New York and stuff, but it was a wonderful night and one that I will always remember. Also got the original Smallwood Singers back together for that project, which was a great, great thing because we've lost two of our members since then, and so it was a blessing. It was the last time we all, you know, sang together. So it was a great, wonderful, memorable night.
Tell us about Promises, your newest project.
Yes, Promises, really for about 4 years, probably, I didn't write. That was when my mother died, right after we did Journey. And it was almost a year before I was really able to go back and go in the studio and finish Journey and put it out. And then after that, it was just a drought, if you will. I couldn't write. I really thought that I had written my last song. I really thought that was it because there was nothing coming. And, of course, I go periods without writing, but this, certainly, I had never gone this long without having any musical ideas or even an interest in doing it. Mm-hmm. So I basically had just sort of said, well, you know, maybe this is it. I've written enough songs. Maybe I've done what I'm supposed to do in terms of writing, and I just want to write again. I'll continue to sing the old songs or whatever. And around that time was when the recession really hit really bad, and I think it affected everyone. And I was sitting in my living room, and God just sort of spoke to me and said, everybody is focusing on what CNN is saying, what MSNBC is saying, and what the media is saying about, you know, the recession and people getting foreclosed in terms of their homes, losing their jobs, whatever. But I've made my people certain promises, and if I promise you that, then I'm going to make sure that it comes to pass. And people need to be reminded of what my promises are. And as soon as I got that feeling of what God was saying in terms of what his promises were, I knew that's what the next CD had to be. And immediately music started coming. In fact, at one point it started coming so fast that I couldn't keep up with it. I've always been a person that writes one song at a time because I've always had a one-track mind. Don't give me, mm-hmm. I cannot multitask. That is not my... That is not my gift. But these songs were coming so fast that I couldn't even keep up with it. I was just like, wow. And they were coming in dreams. They were coming when I was walking down the street. And all of them had to do with God's promises. And that CD means a lot to me because, first of all, it's the first music that I wrote after Mom passed, after not being able to write for so long. And also it really speaks to us and reminds us of the God that we serve, and if he promises that he will be our shelter and our finances and our healer and whatever it is that we need, then he's going to stand by that regardless of what the economy looks like, regardless of what the naysayers say. God is a God of promise, and so that's what that particular project is about. And it's the first studio project that I've done in quite a while since the Smallwood Singers, actually. So I really enjoyed doing it. It's one of the closest to my heart.
We have a last few questions real quick regarding Son of My Joy. When you collaborated with the Gaithers, how did that came to be when you collaborated with them on that?
After the release of the first album with Benson, we went to sing in Indianapolis. Bill Gaither has a praise gathering, a big convention that he has every year, and he invited us. He heard us in Nashville and came up to me and said, you know, would you come and sing at my praise gathering? And we did, and he was so excited about it. He said, you know, have you ever written with anybody else? And I was like, not really. He said, well, would you like to write? I'd love to write with you. And I was like, sure, I'd love to do that. That's quite an honor. So, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about it for a couple of years, but we never really got together. But we happened to be in Nashville at the same time doing business, and we ran into each other. And he said, hey, you got a minute? Let's go find a piano. And that's what we did. We went down in the basement in one of the labels, and he said, I've got this idea about Jesus being the center. He said, I don't know if it's the center of my life, center of my love, center of my existence, center of something, but if I said Jesus was the center of the nucleus of who I am, what do you hear musically when I say that? And I just basically played the chorus like Total Praise, all in one time. It just wasn't like I was, trying to repair it or go back and redo this. It just sort of came all at one time, and that's basically how it was born. We put the lyrics to it from there, and then I think I flew out to his house about maybe a month later, maybe not even that long, and Gloria, his wife, who was an incredible lyricist, she came in, and we started working on the verses together, and that's basically how it came to be.
Okay. Regarding any advice of people coming through the system today, what advice would you give them as musicians and artists?
Well, I think the main thing is that first of all, get an education in your craft. You don't necessarily have to get a degree, but get some kind of knowledge in whatever it is that you do. If you sing, if you're a singer, learn how to sing correctly. If you're a musician, pianist, or whatever, a keyboard player, learn how to read, learn how to play different styles, learn how to be diverse so you can just play more than just the top 10 hits on the Billboard charts. Be able to be diverse, because the more diverse you are, the more work you will get. Always be under a covering so you have a shepherd that can lead you, because this has got to be ministry. It can't be anything else but that. And so you need to get fed so that you can feed other people through your gift. And get people around you who know about the business, who you can trust, who understand your direction, who understand ministry, who understand where you want to go in terms of what God's vision for you is, to assist you in the business end of it. And then learn all you can about the business yourself. So you know what you're doing, you know what you're signing, and what directions to go, the correct direction to go.
Where do you see yourself 100 years from now? How do you like to be remembered?
Just someone who loved God, who loved ministry, and who loved music. And hopefully, my music will, as long as there is a planet Earth, the music will still minister to people. I want my music to be like, the Precious Lord, Take My Hands, the Amazing Graces, those kinds of songs that still minister to people, even today. And the author or the composer doesn't necessarily have to perform it themselves, but in order for it to be effective, but the music has a life of its own, and it has an anointing on it that will bless people and encourage people for years and years to come.
And if there was a song that speaks that says Richard Smallwood, what song would that be?
It'd definitely probably be Total Praise, yeah.
Wow.
It.
Well, Rich, I really appreciate you spending an hour with us and going on a lot of information over a 30-some-odd-plus career in your life at the very beginning. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too, now.
Take care, Richard. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to play a couple of tracks real quick from Richard Smallwood. I'm going to start with Jesus Sent My Joy, I Love the Lord, and I'm going to also play a couple of tracks from his recent album, I Promise. Beginning with Sowing in Tears and Trust. So this one would be Center of My Joy, and the next one would be I Love the Lord.
Heart of my contentment. hope for all I do. Jesus, you're the center of my joy. When I've lost my direction, you're the compass for my way. You're the fire and light when nights are long and cold. In sadness, you are the laughter that shatters all my fears. When I'm all alone, your hand is there to hold. Simple things in life. You're the music in the meadows and the streams. The voices of the children, my family and my home. You're the source and finish of my heart.
You're the heart of my. For all of these things,
all of these things
come to everyone. But in the Word of God, it's promised to us. If your soul listen, tears are for cleansing, stress and relief. They were created by God just to give us relief. Don't worry, they're not in vain. For soon will come peace. For if your soul in tears, you'll reap in joy. Listen, it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. Don't be afraid to cry. Your tears. He hears your prayer. Your mourning, he'll turn to dancing. This too will pass. Your day is coming. The tears. Weeping may endure for a night. Joy is coming in the morning.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.